The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello again. Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as every week, I'll be taking us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those, of course, rich with the essence of constant renewal, and that is the way we love to open the show every week. Well, it is exciting to be back again today. We are continuing with the big picture that we put in motion last week. We are continuing with focus on our financial world and building upon last week's emphasis on our deficit blues here in the United States. Today, though, our focus is on the story of what we might call the quiet coup, a story of Wall Street and the financial sector of the U.S. and how they have increasingly, and in many ways surreptitiously, meaning quietly without great notice, how they have amassed immense power in our political system, how they've co-opted power at large, and in many ways how they have forged a clear balance of power that gives the financial sector true and ultimate veto power over public policy in America. They've even done that as they have lost much public and popular support in our most recent crisis. But let me open the day to you with a question. And let me put it this way, a question for you. Would you make this bet? If I were to ask you to put up $1,000 and with that $1,000 spend a week in a Las Vegas casino, you get to go to an IOU window and you get to leverage that $1,000 50 times. In other words, you borrow for pennies on a dollar or less, you're able to borrow $50,000 as an IOU against that $1,000 you've got, and you get to keep all the winnings in the casino based on whatever you earn, whatever you gather at the tables using that $1,000 to $50,000. The catch, you got to stay a week. And at the end of the week, even though the $50,000 may be gone, you don't have to pay for it. All you might lose is the $1,000 you put up. And one more thing, as you think about this bet, you get inside the house. In other words, you get to see the house cards. You know exactly what they know. So I ask you, would you take that bet? And I think, folks, that may be a loose analogy, but I think it in part is part of the analogy to our story today, which I really hope to make clear, which I really hope to flesh out in a way that you'll understand the nature of the casino, the nature of the bets being made, the nature and the context of the financial system at play, and the way the financial sector has really built themselves into a powerhouse and is really driving much of our action. And to build our story, I'm including the work, I think, of two important people among others today. And first, I'm going to include filmmaker and director Charles Ferguson. He's the man behind the critically acclaimed movie that's in theaters today. And that movie is called The Inside Job. It's a film I've seen a couple of times already. I saw it last Friday afternoon again. And I would say it is a most definitive film about the economic crisis of 2008. It is a definitive film about the role of Wall Street in modern society, and I think it's one that everyone should really see. This film provides a perspective. Clearly, it has a point of view. But I think the film is sweeping, and it's nonpartisan in its critique, and I think it covers the historical roots of the crisis and the central flaws of global financial regulation. I think it does it well. I think it does with a stimulating feel and flavor, and I think you'll love it. Matt Damon does the provocative narrative to the film, And I think, as Time Magazine puts it in a quote I saw not too long ago, if you're not enraged by the end of the movie, you weren't and you aren't paying attention. And so today, I don't expect in our conversation any kind of an emotional reaction like that. In fact, I'm going to try to cover the bases in a way that's going to have a fair amount of perspective and data, and it may not have that sense of emotion and drama. It clearly won't have the sense of interviews, the who's who that's in the film, but I think it's going to have the perspectives, and you're going to get the message and why I'm actually doing this. And second, today, I'm going to bring forward the work of Simon Johnson. He is the co-author of the book, 13 Bankers, the Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He is formerly chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He is actually one of the ones that provides the synthesis, the clarity of writing, the view of the financial system that over the last several years I have seen few that do it as well. And I think he puts that to clear attention in his book. What I'm doing is pulling together some thoughts. I'm synthesizing that with Charles in terms of what he presents the film, and I'm trying to provide a perspective here. And we're going to invite both Charles and Simon to be with us on Zoom after the first of the year. But before we have them on, I want to set the stage with some of our show today that can provide a context, a linkage of them together. Their work, I think it's important for us to connect the dots on a macro view and to do that before we engage them on the show with some more particulars. I think we need a ground bed. And I think to be able to really talk with them, to engage them, we need some of what we're going to bring forward today. So today I really want to do three things as I fly solo with you. First, I'd like to lay out the skeleton for the coup. This is what we've been experiencing. It's been a progressive buildup of power. It's been orchestrated through a combination of deregulation and through the revolving door of executives between Wall Street and the various administrations we've been seeing in Washington since the 80s. I want to make that clear. I'm going to provide a history, or at least a summary of that as we go forward. But second, after laying out that foundation, I want to answer the question about why would Wall Street make that bet? Why would they make a boom or bust bet? Why would they risk it all for the prospects of immense gain? You've already answered that. You've made an answer to the bet. What I'd like to do is give you Wall Street's answer, and that in part points to the Federal Reserve System and how implicitly they are enabling Wall Street and this bet. That's part of what I want to do in part two. And part three, what I want to do is I want to lay out what I think is a big loophole. Simon Johnson thinks it's a big loophole. It's the financial reform legislation from last summer that was intended to provide a fix to all of what we're talking about so we don't find these kinds of problems in the future. And most importantly, I think what we're going to describe is the too big to fail is getting even bigger. It's becoming now too global to fail. That's what I'd like to do in our three parts today. And then some closing comments, perhaps about leadership, building upon where we've talked about before. So without much ado, though, let's get started in the backdrop of this quiet coup. You know, I think it's important because as many of us, we've lived over the last 20 or 30 years, we've experienced this, but we don't always connect the dots as clearly. And I think that Charles Ferguson's done that. I think Simon does that well, and I'd like to do that as we get started today. You know, I think there's much of what's in the film, which is about the engineered financial products, an awful lot of that, but I think the story and the history behind it is important. And what I'd like to do is just to sort of walk through, summarize. I don't want to get lost in this, but I'd like to paint a picture here for a couple of minutes about what we've been experiencing and then go from there. Because out of this whole thing, the financial sector has not always received the favored treatment that they're getting now. In fact, if we go back to the 30s and the post-depression, which was motivated by the financial abuses that came out of the depression itself, what we really saw out of the depression were really substantive laws. The Glass-Steagall Act, which I'll speak to more in a minute, the Securities Exchange Act, which placed limits on financial risk-taking, on the bets being made, and required extensive disclosure of financial information. All of that was put together in a way to provide a regulated financial sector, really a tight one. It's probably the era of the traditional American finance. They got kicked off then through the late 70s. Bankers and traders in that era, they made salaries that were in line with other professionals, and they had a tightly knit structure and a system for operating. But in the 1980s, we moved on. President Reagan came in, and we began the era of laissez-faire trickle-down economics. And it might be characterized best by the ideology of Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan. We've all heard his name. He was an icon to us for many years. But he was strongly set in the views of the free market, the objectivist movement, as we might call it, stimulated by the writer Ayn Rand. You might recall her really prominent work, Atlas Shrugged, the book that provided the context of it. But in essence, Greenspan lived out of that, blessed freedom, and opposed any sort of regulation. And Greenspan solidified his ideology as a political advisor to Nixon, and by the time he became really onto the scene with the Fed in the 80s, his views were fixed, and they meant no regulation. So what we saw in this early buildup, in the 80s, we saw a substantial amount of deregulation. We saw it in savings and loans. First, we saw it via the Garn-St. Germain Act, which led later to the savings and loans crisis. We saw that being immortalized, I think, in culture by the film Wall Street. If you remember that, we're getting the second version of that right these days. But we saw the greed, we saw the immortality, we saw the reality being painted, and at the same time, what we really were beginning to live then was the reality of the SNL scandal, hundreds of SNLs failing, lax enforcement, all of that led to massive fraud, loose regulations, all of that leading to a big, big word, $124 billion taxpayer-funded bailout. So we begin to see the essence of this, the bailouts, and this is a prominent one. We begin to get into that 90 or the 80s. We begin to see the Keating Five. You begin to see the influence peddling. You begin to see people going to prison for it. The onset of some of the fraud and insider trading that you're beginning to see in the bond markets with Michael Milken, Ivan Bosky, and other executives. You begin to see that starting to play out in the 80s. But you see in the 80s the beginning of this. You begin to see the movement. You begin to see the feeling of it. And I want to continue. I want to paint a picture of the 80s, just a big picture of the 90s and 2000. I want to bring us forward into this. I want to set the stage because I want to give a sense of the environment being created, the coup that's in the flow, and a sense of the bets being made. That's where I'd like to progress on Zoom. Let's take a short break. I hear the music in my ears. Come back in just a moment. Great to be with you today. Thanks.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
It's all Eric.
Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Classes in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's avastoneconsulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, here we are back on Zoomed. We are talking about the quiet coup today. That's our focus. It is about how Wall Street has taken over key aspects of our policymaking in the U.S., of taking over the influence of our financial system. And what I'm providing here is just a short kind of a picture here as a historical perspective to get us going. And where I left us was the 80s. And I'd like to make a couple of other comments on that, because in the 80s, what we saw were the investment bankers first going public. They started to raise huge amounts of capital. They started to transcend their roots as partnerships, which is how they were initially structured, where the partners put up the dollars and were responsible for it. Just like in our casino, they would actually be responsible for what was actually happening and for the losses they might have. We saw the beginnings of that starting to really roll over, because it shifted as they started to go public. We saw the beginnings also of the revolving door between Wall Street and the administration. We saw Don Regan, head of Merrill Lynch, become Treasury Secretary under Reagan. And we saw that in, as we got into the 90s, even become more pervasive in the Clinton era, and saw even more development between Wall Street and Washington and that door going back and forth. We saw Robert Rubin, head of Goldman Sachs. He joined the administration. He became Treasury Secretary. Saw other Clinton administration members with Wall Street backgrounds begin to get into influenced to start what I would say is the direct capture of the political system. And that resulted in the Graham-Bleach-Bliley Act, really, which repealed what I mentioned early on was the Glass-Steagall, coming out of the Depression, which was removing then the separation that existed between investment banks and depository banks. And that was there, which was created in the Depression to help manage this speculative risk. What it did, it was allowed mergers and bankings to become mega groups. We see Citicorp as an example of that. And no longer was the need to compartmentalize banking risk. We started to break that down. And an example, I've talked about I spend some time in oil and gas. If you look at the way that ships actually transport oil around the world, they don't do it with one big whole compartment of oil. They have separate compartments in there. So if problems happen in one compartment, they don't systemically impact the whole. In the 90s, we got rid of that. We got rid of that risk and safety feature in the financial system. In 94, a new law gave the Federal Reserve the power to regulate the mortgage industry and the problems that were to come. But Alan Greenspan, as Fed chairman, refused to enact the regulations on the grounds that regulation was unnecessary. In 2000, we saw a mix of Larry Summers, Alan Greenspan. We saw key members of Congress. We saw Phil Graham. He was a key member behind this, enact the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which banned all of the regulation of derivatives and exempted them from anti-gambling laws. In essence, we created the derivatives then. We made the bets in the actual casino legal. And many call these the weapons of mass destruction of our times in the financial world, but they were exempted from regulation. This was on the heels of recommended policy changes that came out of Brooksley Bourne within the Clinton administration. She was at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. She wanted to regulate these and actually probably could have forestalled the recent crisis, but she was swept aside and that recommendation ignored. So we move on. In 2000, we see a dot-com bubble. We see bursts happening in that. We see Elliot Spitzer, who comes on, sues eight of the big investment banks for conflict of interest. They were recommending dot-com stocks to their customers, which they thought were junk. It all settled for about $1.25 billion in fines. And then we go and we progress further into the 2000s. We see George Bush pushing for further deregulation, relaxed enforcement. We see new crops, highly complex financial innovations begin to flourish. We see securitization of mortgages, credit default swaps, synthetic CDOs, all of the terms that we've been reading about in the last 3 years, all of that coming to bear. All of that's fed by the investment banking industry and the complex financial instruments and a massive housing and mortgage credit bubble, what we all know about, what we've been talking about 3 years, sweeps the U.S. Mortgage lending quadruples, housing prices double, and in 2004, after intense lobbying by the investment banks, they get the kind of leverage that I offered you in the bet. They get 33-1. Instead of 50-1, what I gave you. The casino has now new leverage as well. International Monetary Fund economist Raghuram Rajan warns of dangerous incentives at that point in time and risks in the financial system. He is one that comes to a major meeting in the U.S. and talks to the major economists in the world, in the U.S. and administration. He's called a Luddite. He's just holding down the new technology. So in 2005, 2008, we see Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Bank, all these others are beginning to use the derivatives. They're beginning to bet against the very products they created and they made their fortunes on. Revolving door continues. Hank Paulson, CEO of Goldman Sachs, comes into the administration as Treasury Secretary. 2007, the housing bubble bursts. 2008, the Great Recession begins. Bear Stearns, Lehman collapses. AIG is actually rescued with $85 billion, which is directly, that's AIG, directly paid as the counterparties through AIG, paid by Hank Paulson to Goldman and others, 100% on the dollar. We see the $700 billion emergency bailout package. It's passed for the financial industry. In essence, we've heard many times the financial industry privatized the gains, they socialized the losses, and they served their interests well, and their immense risk-taking stuck it to the public with their losses. That's part of the picture. That's part of what we're really talking about here. As you might progress from this, Wall Street did extremely well. How well? Well, back in the days from 73 to maybe 85, they were making money about 16% on profit. 86, it reached 19%. 90s, 21-30%. In the 2000, this past decade, it reached 41%. 2007. And the pay that they made, you've seen the salaries, you've heard about the bonuses, it actually evolved from being pretty fit with all other industries, maybe on par or slightly above through about 1982. From there on, it kept rising, spiking, and reached 181% of the norm in 2007. So great wealth that the sector had created gave bankers enormous weight. But the financial industry gained power and political power not by this wealth alone, but by amassing a kind of cultural capital, really a belief system. And once perhaps what was good for GM was good for the country, but what happened over the past decade, the attitude took hold that what was good for Wall Street was good for the country. The banking and the securities industry has become one of the top contributors to political campaigns. They employ on average 5 lobbyists for every member of Congress. And at its peak of influence, they didn't have to do what tobacco companies did or the military complex. They already had insiders in place. The large financial institutions and the free-flowing, unregulated capital markets and the sense of them being crucial to America's standing in the world, it was already in the mindsets at play. It was in each of the administrations. The channel of influence we've talked about, we've heard the names before, Don Regan, Robert Rubin, Jon Snow, Hank Paulson, many of these, but the personal connections were multiplied many, many times over at the lower levels during the last 3 administrations, strengthening what happens between Wall Street and the administration itself. And this has continued in the Obama administration, including the continuity of players from previous administrations to the Obama team, and that reflects the continuing financial industry and the culture of deregulation and self-absorbed interest. 7 names in the Obama administration you'll see in the inside job come from this continuity. I won't go through all of them, but you need to see it, you need to feel it, you need to sense it. But inside job, I think, makes this point clear. That by laying out the evidence, I think you'll see, and I think you'll get a sense, that the Obama administration is, in essence, still a Wall Street government. And in essence, a whole generation of policymakers have been mesmerized by Wall Street, always and utterly convinced that whatever the banks said was true. And one example of that, in 2006, Bernanke, who succeeded Greenspan, the management of market risk and credit risk has become increasingly sophisticated. Banking organizations of all sizes have made substantial strides over the past 2 decades in their ability to measure and manage risk. Oh, really? Of course, this was mostly an illusion. Regulators, legislators, academics, almost all assume that the managers of these banks knew what they were doing. In retrospect, they didn't, or they knew what they were doing and simply said, I'll make that bet. And that leads me to the second part of our examination, the second part of, I think, our focus on what would make Wall Street think. I can take that bet. I can make it. I can take that risk, and I can do it and get away with it. And for that answer, I think we need to go to Simon Johnson. Examine what he says about the Federal Reserve, because I think it's very informful, very insightful to us. I hear the music in my ears. Let's take a short break. Let's come back and let's talk about the bet. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve. Let's talk about the enabling of the casino. Be back in a moment. Thanks. You're on Zoomed.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
It's football, pop culture, and everything in between. Get ready for The Game Plan with Anthony Herron, a.k.a. Big Ant. Anthony has a background in college and professional football and brings the player, coach, and broadcaster perspective to this weekly roundup of the top sports news and events. Big Ant wants to hear from you, too. Tune in to The Game Plan with Anthony Herron every Tuesday afternoon at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Sports Channel. It's game time.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom today, we are talking about the quiet coup, the implications of it, what's really going on. That's part of our conversation. You can tell I got a lot of energy for this. This is a sort of a passionate realm, I think, of understanding that we have about what is going on because we live with it. We're living with this great recession, and I think you'll see as we go forward, we're going to be living potentially with other large shocks in the future. But let me begin to paint the picture of why. Because to many observers, as I was saying, to understand the Federal Reserve, to understand, as Simon Johnson says, the Federal Reserve, in many respects, has never looked more heroic than it has amid this recent crisis. Many of the accolades for averting the disaster are going to the Fed, and President Obama himself has ratified this analysis, I think, when he renominated Bernanke for a second term. But in that, he said his background, his temperament, his courage, his creativity, all of that helped prevent a second Great Depression. Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But what these words, I think, and I think what Simon Johnson would say, these words of presidential praise have obscured, in many respects, that, in Simon's words, the Fed may well have mitigated our current crisis by sowing seeds for the next one. All modern economies need a financial system that can connect people who want to save those who want to save with those who want good investments. That's what the banks do. But unfortunately, this process often goes wrong, and that's what is happening now. Our banks have gotten into the habit of needing to be rescued through repeated bailouts. And during this crisis, Bernanke, while saving the financial system in the short term, has done nothing to break this long-term pattern. Even worse, he's exacerbated it. And as a result, unless real reform happens, we face the prospect of another bubble-bust bailout cycle that will even be worse than the dangerous one we've just been through. That's in Simon's words himself. So I think as you would study, if we took a look at economic history, Simon does that, he presents that, he brings it forward, none of this would come as a surprise, I think, if we look at the historical pattern there the way I did in the beginning, but look at this specifically in terms of the bailouts. The spectacles, the Fed saving us from one crisis, which actually then instigates another, it's been happening many times before. And the fault doesn't entirely go with the Fed. It looks like, to me, Bernanke's really a prisoner of the financial system. There's serious built-in flaws. The decisions he makes seems to me that they're not necessarily wrong. They were probably the ones he had to make. But these decisions, however necessary in the moment, are almost guaranteed, as Simon describes, to hurt our economy in the long run, which means more necessary but harmful measures will be needed in the future. To me, I would have to say it feels like a debilitating, vicious cycle. And at the center of the cycle is the Fed. At the center of it is the bailout and our understanding about why banks believe we can make that bet. In general, I think, from what I'm able to see and what I'm able to glean out of this, the Fed repeatedly gives or provides lifelines to banks that need the help. And this happens in two broad ways. And for us laymen, I would say it happens through what I see as liquidity loans, meaning they give them short-term loans that they can roll over as many times probably as they need. And it happens through lower interest rates, which increases the bank's profits by reducing the cost of their funding. And it seems to me that these efforts help mitigate the individual disasters, but by insulating the banks from the consequences of their own bad decisions or their own blunders, these measures also encourage taking unwise risks and thereby laying the foundation, the groundwork for future crises. The Fed didn't create the atmosphere of this elevated risk, I don't think. I don't think Simon believes that either, but it has ended up playing a central role in perpetuating it. Since the 80s, from what I can see, successive financial crises have required ever more dramatic reactions by the Fed. Every time there's a meltdown, the Fed comes in, they quickly cut short-term rates. These rates have gotten larger and larger over time. Now, essentially, as we see, they're close to zero. Each round, these cuts make sense, but they help bring about the next crisis. Every crisis seems to me to have its distinctive features, but the broad pattern is the same. And Simon brings this to light in some of his work in the book and some of the papers he's written. Paul Volcker did that with the Latin American crisis when it broke out in the 80s. He lowered the cost of funding speculative real estate deals, and he combined that with regulatory breakdown. All that helped pave the way for the S&L crisis. And then on the heels of that, Greenspan cut rates after the stock market crash of 87. All that developed into real estate problems in the late 80s and 90s. The resulting credit boom helped unrelated financial exuberance that went on then in emerging markets. We saw one calamity after another. Mexico, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Korea, and Russia all experienced them between 95 and 98. Then in 98, we saw the failure of the lightly regulated hedge fund, long-term capital management, and so on and so on. I won't go through all of them. But in a bright, shining moment, seems to me, markets somewhere realized that the Fed was prepared through interest rate cuts and loose credit to do whatever it took to bail out the financiers that are facing large losses. Risk-taking without fear for the consequences has become the name of the game, and at least for our largest financial players, that's what they now have in their minds. That is their mindset. They get the upside if things go well, and the Fed will limit their downside risk when the speculative frenzy runs out of gas. This seemed to create the tech bubble. It's what we saw in the real estate bubble. And over the last century, we've moved away from a system, as I was saying earlier on, where the bank shareholders and the execs pay dearly for this. We see that actually as just the contrary. And we've moved toward a system where the bosses who are actually fired, they make off with fortunes. They might even launch brilliant political careers. Maybe the example we just saw here in recent times is Chuck Prince, at CEO of Citibank, who fell flat in what he was doing. What did he walk away with? $100 million. So in summary, if we were to consider the lessons learned from, I think, these recent crises at our major banks, if they get into serious trouble, what our lesson learned is the Fed can be counted on to lend them essentially unlimited amounts at effectively zero percentage rates. And what do you do with the money? You pay off old debts, then you find something to invest in that yields decent returns. But then, why not take more risk? And after all, if things go badly, you'll get more free money. And that, to me, sets up the case that we're talking about for the casino. It sets up the case for enabling the notion, the whole orientation to high-risk bets, and how we're actually able to, and the way the financial system looks at and attends to their interests prior to any other interests. So what I've done here over these first segments is I've laid down some financial history. I think I've reflected on some of why the banks are making that bet. My guess is, because as I prepared for the show today, I said to myself, well, if I were you, I'd really want to sit here and say, where are we now? And I know that some of you are also thinking, well, didn't we fix all this last summer? We had the Dodd-Frank bill that went before Congress. We had a financial reform legislation. Did we get what we needed? Well, I think that's a great question. And I think the answer is, well, not exactly. Because the financial reform has a terrible loophole as part of it. And as you might have guessed, given the flow of what we're talking about, the banks have found it. So I haven't talked today too much in detail, as the film Inside Job does, about all the factors that have led to the crisis of 2008. Inside Job does a good job of it. Charles does a magnificent job. You'll get a clear sense of it, and you'll get a clear sense of the way the dangerous derivatives were put together with the whole ecosystem and connections in it. You'll understand the irresponsible rating agencies. You'll understand the regulators asleep at the wheel. But one problem was perhaps the biggest of all, and that's the one I think that we need to pull close with and look at put our attention scan today, and that is the too-big-to-fail problem. What brought the economy to the edge of disaster wasn't only that financial institutions had to make rash bets on lousy investments, but that these institutions were so massive that their bets, when they went bad, they threatened to take down the economy, the whole system, as they went down. And that's why Washington was forced to come to the rescue with billions in bailouts for AIG and Citigroup, and why we had a $750 billion bailout. When focusing on making the financial system safer, Obama actually vowed, I quote, never again will the taxpayer be held hostage by the bank that is too big to fail. Well, good ideas. I think good ideas here. They came forward. And I think if some of you really stayed with the press and really stay attuned to this, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, who in the spring came out in an op-ed in Washington Post, called for what was really described then as a resolution authority. You say, well, what's a resolution authority? What is that? Does that have anything to do with this? Well, it is a procedure, yes, that would be run by the government to wind down a failing bank so that if you made a bad bet in the casino, you would pay for it. And in theory, the way it would work is the resolution authority would send the signal to bankers through this resolution authority that they couldn't count on a bailout. In other words, they would try to deter these dangerous strategies at the source. And if they did fold, it would define a clear, efficient process for making it happen quickly. Be a bit like the FDIC does now for banks with insured retail deposits, but now it would be applied to any financial institution. That's what Jamie Dimon suggested in the op-ed. That was part of what started to circulate the conversation, and it sounded good. It sounded very good. In fact, it had backers across the political spectrum, from Geithner to Paulson to Dimon to the whole mix of players we're talking about. And the good news, it did get included in the bill's passage in July. But there's bad news. And so far, so good may not be enough. And that's where I want to go when we come back. I hear the message in my ears. Come back and let me tell you about what we really got, what really is going on. Let me talk about the escape clause, because I think that's important for our perspective in the future. When we're talking and thinking about deficits of last week, we're thinking about our financial situation going forward, personally, organizationally, for our national system, for the world at large. We need to understand this escape clause because the casino lives on. Take a break. Come right back in a moment. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? the way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8888. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Tune in every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. On the show, Aldana and some of today's top business professionals will discuss some of today's most pressing business issues that hold you, the business owner, back. Aldana will also give you 21 ways to grow with her list of growth strategies. Grow smart, grow profit, and grow your business with Aldana Ambler and The Growth Strategist every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on The Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back today, last segment. Well, I really want to connect the dots relative to the coup, relative to the bet, and why the system is actually driving that, and where we are now. Did we make the changes we were talking about in the last segment? Did we make the changes with the resolution authority? And the answer to the question is, yes, we did. So far, so good. Well, it sounds good on the surface, but there's a flaw, or at a minimum, as I was saying, an escape clause. The resolution authority does not cover, let me say that again, does not cover global financial activities. Well, in fact, it can't, because in the legislature, including Congress and any place around the world, you can't really pass a law that defines what will happen in other countries' legal system. So in Damey Dimon's own words, if there's going to be a crisis every 5 to 7 years, all a bank does now has to do to escape or to sidestep the resolution authority is to grow so large that it is vital to not just the U.S. economy, but the entire international financial system. So if one of those mega banks goes under, the government, again, will have no choice but to step in and provide full creditor protection. In effect, the resolution authority would be absolutely meaningless. So the next question, this is where I sat with it, and I suspect is where it might be in your own minds, is it happening? Are banks trying to become bigger and even more global? Are they actually taking those steps, and is it intrinsic to the process? And the answer is absolutely, across the globe. Jamie Dimon, from what I can gather, and as Simon has really described, Dimon and J.P. Morgan's had long-term ambitions to make themselves a global bank, and others are on board as well, Citigroup, HSBC, Barclays, Deutsche Bank. They're all sending signals about becoming not just too big to fail, but too global to fail. And with the notion of too global to fail comes a recognition of what in the industry is called the Chuck Prince problem, which is named after Chuck Prince during the 2007 meltdown, when he was quoted as saying, well, when the music stops in terms of liquidity, things will get complicated. But as long as the music is playing, you got to get up and you got to dance. And we're still dancing. And what that really means is, if all your competitors are betting big on a particularly risky market, a particularly risky bet, it's almost impossible not to do the same thing yourself, because your investors are going to judge you against your rivals. as Simon would say, one has to be heroically disciplined to primly stand aside while everyone else is gorging themselves. And the CEOs of the financial institutions don't tend to be heroically disciplined. Well, wow. I got to tell you, that all sounds to me like the tragedy of the commons brewing. We all know it's a problem, but nobody will not do it. What we all need to see here, and perhaps even, most importantly, the Obama administration, if we could get a wake up there, is that the large U.S. banks, as well as many of the foreign ones, seem to have ambitions to create global giants that America now cannot afford to see fail. And yet, just as importantly, we cannot afford to bail out either. Let me say that again. America can't afford to bail them out either. That was part of our conversation last week on the deficit blues, that the deficit that we have is putting us into a position where we don't have the flexibility to deal with these kind of problems any longer. Treasury Secretary Geithner and others argue that the resolution authority could be negotiated through some kind of an international agreement, but from what actually seems to be the case, if you go to the Basel Committee and Banking Supervisions, in their words, there is no international insolvency framework for financial firms and a limited prospect of one being created in the future. Wow. Sounds to me like if we fast forward, and let's say we were saying, as Jamie Dimon says, 5 years out, let's say J.P. Morgan's in trouble on the brink of insolvency, that we're back to 2008, and we're back to the basic choice. Do we bail them out, or do we have a global meltdown? But this time, it's bigger. This time, it's worse than the last one. So it's an amazing perspective that we're building here. And by the way, the Dodd-Frank bill did have a chance to address this problem. During the debate last spring, Senators Brown and Ted Kaufman proposed an amendment that would have made the largest banks small enough and simple enough to fail. Obama's Wall Street Treasury opposed the provision, and it died. The quiet coup took decisive action again, and to protect the system as it is, it further went into the bankers' own realm of they have the ultimate veto power. So it's amazing. It's amazing. And in the film Inside Job, in his director statement, I really resonated with this. He really pointed to three elements, three reflections that I think maybe is a good thing to close with on Zoom today. That the financial industry has turned its back on society. It is out for its best interest to the possible detriment of others. Who cares if taxpayers end up holding the bag. And second, if there's substantial corruption involved, which it looks as if there is, even if we haven't prosecuted any of those that are involved in it because of the coup at play, perhaps we'll see more of this with the WikiLeaks. Maybe we'll actually see what's really going on. But I think he's really pointing to there's corruption in the system, and it's actually a part of it. It is part of the mainstream culture. Will be interesting to see. But the final piece, the same people who have been structuring the system for their benefit are the same ones that are running it. They're the same things that they're doing today. And in the words of Charles, I think there's some things that are worth fighting for. And this, my friends, might really be one of them. Right up there with the deficit, right up there with control of our lives, this seems to me to be an issue of sovereignty. Seems to me to be an issue of sovereignty directly connected to our conversation on Zoomed, which is around leadership, and our leadership underpinned and embraced by a flow of our own presence and bringing to bear the kind of focus and perhaps even the courage to get in the game on this and stop this whole thing from progressing. You know, I've spoken these words on Zoomed before. I have talked about sovereignty. I've talked about it in context of the commons. What's common to our lives. We talked about the water, the air, the lands, all of this. We've talked about all the cultural dimensions, and the wealth, the intellectual assets involved. But I got to say, as we close here today and we start moving in, the global financial system, in my view, is just such a commons. And we've lost our sovereignty over it. The financial firms are really running the show. They're doing it toward their own interest, and society at large is the backdrop to holding the bag and the enduring of whatever pain might come from these risky financial ventures of the future, those that might go bad. So as we close today, I'd like to leave you with a thought and actually to bring to light the perspective of the leadership theorist Robert Terry, as he once called it. Leadership is authentic action in the commons. Authentic action in the commons. That means you, that means me, and that means actions both small and local and those that are large and more national and global. And that authentic part really seems to me it brings back to the beacon of authenticity, to what's real and true, and to our own presence garnered into the real work that needs to be done. So, folks, I wanted to give a big picture view of this. We're going to continue on this focus. We're going to bring it to life. Simon will join us. Charles will join us. Let's continue the conversation. But you get a sense of what's going on here. And I've been clear about it. Perhaps we can be clear. Maybe we can flush it out. Maybe we can even build on the perspective, because maybe it is more cloudy than I'm presenting. But in essence, it is a big picture, and we need to get connected to it. We need to be up close and personal, and we do need to flow forward and exercise our leadership. Have a great week, folks. Been great energy. Great to be with you. Guests will be returning shortly. I just wanted to do a couple of shows to get some big themes on the table. Again, as always, have a great week and enjoy out here. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.